This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's a rule of thumb in the news business. War sells newspapers. It's good for ratings. It's one of those rare moments when almost everyone wants to stay up to date. As journalists, it's our responsibility to tell our readers and listeners and viewers what they need to know accurately and fairly and quickly. It's never easy, and war presents a unique set of editorial dilemmas. How much should we trust official sources? How long do we keep journalists on the front lines when their lives might be in danger? How many sources do we rely on to confirm a story that could spread panic? Do you publish or broadcast important information if the government doesn't want you to, or if the military says it might risk the lives of American soldiers? And how important is it to scoop the competition? Today, we'll talk with executives from three news organizations who may face those questions and others in the days and weeks ahead. Andrew Rosenthal of the New York Times, Marcy McGinnis of CBS, and Bruce Drake of NPR News. We'll also speak with media critic William Sarin. And we want to hear from you. What do you expect from your news sources when the country is at war? Do your expectations change during war? Do you worry about reporters risking themselves to get the story? Or our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his office in New York City is Andrew Rosenthal, Assistant Managing Editor for the New York Times. And it's good of you to join us today.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here, Neil. Thank you.
Let's start with a story that appeared in the Washington Post this morning. It's about the difficult decisions that news executives have right now about whether or not to keep journalists in Baghdad. Does the New York Times still have people there?
We are trying to withdraw our people. I'm not sure at this minute where they are. We had two people, John Burns, who's one of our most experienced foreign correspondents, and Tyler Hicks, a photographer. They've both been in Baghdad and out of Baghdad, and we made a decision that we would withdraw them as the inevitability of war got closer. It's a little more complicated than just getting on an airplane and leaving. Getting out of Iraq can almost be as difficult as getting into it. But we did instruct John and Tyler to leave.
Is the decision based on the danger that they face? Because obviously you would want to stay in Baghdad if you could to report the story.
Yeah, it is. You know, in all of these cases, when you're dealing with the risk of war coverage, which I often had to do when I was a foreign editor as well as in my current job, you have to strike a balance between covering the story, which is an imperative for our mission to society, and also obviously a competitive question, and what the risks are. We have a very simple equation for the amount of casualties we're willing to accept, which is zero. In a situation like this, where you've got people in what is about to become the capital of a country that is involved in hostilities with the United States, and the United States is going to be bombing, we felt that the only principled position that we could take was to take the reporters out. Some people talk about leaving it up to their judgment, but we believe that this is a decision that the institution has to make, and that we can't put the burden on the reporter to decide for himself or herself.
Every war is different. Of course, you in part base your decisions about the coming war on what's happened in previous ones, though. But
certainly,
the difference this time is one of the big differences will be the embedded journalists, the journalists who are going to be embedded with units of the American and I guess the British military as well. Is the New York Times participating in this system?
Yes, we are. We have something like 15 people involved.
Now, there's some difficult issues. There are rules about what can and can't be reported by these embedded journalists. There's also the fact that the reporters spend a great deal of time with soldiers in a difficult environment, and, becoming sympathetic is almost natural.
That's always an issue, and it's a complicated one. For one thing, we don't tell our reporters that they're not allowed to have sympathies or opinions. We just tell them to keep it out of their news writing, which is a big difference. And that is one of the principles of journalism. In this case, the embedding opportunity was offered to us, and it really wasn't a question of whether we could dictate the Pentagon's rules, which we can, but whether we would go or not go.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that we were being afforded an opportunity that we should take. We have to take it with all of the caveats that you mentioned. And I should point out that we have a larger number of reporters who are covering this war independently that are not embedded.
Those are so-called unilaterals.
That's what people call them, yes.
and
we just prefer to think of them as our reporters.
I understand that. But those people would be also going in the field and independent of the military.
And they are, in fact, in the field. We have had a reporter who has been in northern Iraq since December 3rd, was Chris Chivers, who has done wonderful reporting from there. We have another, and he's been with a photographer. We have another reporter there. We have them all around the region. We have them in Kuwait. We have at the both at the military complex there and independently. They're all over the place. When you cover a war of any kind, you have to kind of triangulate it. You know, it was our experience in every other place, in Kosovo, in Afghanistan. You know, you can't just rely on the opportunities that the military gives you. To abandon those opportunities, we think, would be foolish, because at the very least, you've got somebody who's been an eyewitness to all kinds of interesting things, and if there are restrictions on what they can report at the moment that they're seeing it, that material will become available at some time.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. Our first caller is Neil, who's joining us from Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to point out, actually, I was reading the Baltimore Sun yesterday, and I came across a piece that I think it was an Arkansas paper, has recalled one of their reporters because, well, she was scheduled to be one of these embedded reporters, and actually in the process got engaged to a lieutenant colonel over there and has now been recalled. And I think that just shows the danger of this objectivity and this idea of reporting the truth sort of being vulnerable, the idea that people will start to connect too closely with the soldiers, and it just can't be helped.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's a danger. And the other thing I did want to comment about was in the last war about how there was a lot of reporting about this infallibility of the Patriot missiles and how great they were, and it turns out that they were not very accurate at all, and I just really have concerns as to how much real good information we're going to get from the process. And of course, the Pentagon obviously has something to benefit from constructing this approach.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much. I'd like to hear the comments.
Okay, thanks for the call, Neil.
Well, that's pretty unusual. I could make the argument that you ought to take heart in what the newspaper did. They recalled the reporter, which was precisely and exactly the right thing to do. There's always the danger of people developing sympathies. And remember, this is not brand new. It's just organized. You know, in Vietnam, reporters went out with military units. It happened all the time. And, you know, I think your average war correspondent may be more likely to be sympathetic to a soldier in the field than, you know, your average ticket taker at the movie theater. But that doesn't mean that they can't be dispassionate in their coverage. I don't know what objective means exactly in this context. I think that we have to be dispassionate, and we have to be fair, and we have to keep our own opinions out of the copy.
What about the second part of his question and the lessons from the last Gulf War about what the military was saying about the Patriot missiles? They were saying, there's another hit, and it turned out that wasn't it at all, and they knew it.
Yeah, well, you have to check it. You have to check everything the military tells you. You have to. One of the important things that journalists need to remember, and I think sometimes it tends to be forgotten, you know, particularly in the rush of 24-hour-a-day television internet coverage, is that we have to tell people what we're presenting them. We're presenting them with what the Pentagon is saying. We're not presenting them with our own unvarnished facts. And we go back, our own investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back and we do it. I remember in Panama, which was the first use of this stealth fighter, which evaded the non-existent Panamanian radar, and according to the Pentagon, had dropped a 1,000-pound bomb precisely and exactly on his target. And our Michael Gordon, who is now our chief military correspondent, went down to Panama later, and he saw that target still standing. And then he walked around and found a gigantic hole in the ground 5 miles away, took a picture of both, and went back to the Pentagon, and they had to admit they missed. I mean, that's a tiny thing, the Patriot thing. Everything needs to be revisited. You know, you have to. It is our obligation to report what the Pentagon is saying about what's going on, because people have a right to hear what the government is saying. But we shouldn't take ownership of it. We shouldn't pretend that it's truth. We should just pretend that we should just be honest about where it's coming from, and then we should go back and check it and check it again and check it again and check it again.
Which is another thing people are saying about these embedded reporters, that even if stuff can't be reported immediately or with the immediacy that they and their newspaper or their broadcast organization might want, it will come out later.
That's exactly correct. And I think if you look at some of the things that they're talking about are not printing, for example, that we shouldn't print troop movements in advance of an operation. You know, that is the easiest and oldest decision that any journalist has to make. We don't do it. And the reasons are just obvious. You know, lives are at stake. We're not in the business of endangering the lives of American or British or any other kind of soldier. There are some other things. You know, apparently we got some heat the other day. We ran a photograph. We did a feature story about the Marines, and I think it was about was mostly about how they were going to have to go out and deal with casualties. It was one of these embedded reports. And there was a picture that the reporter took of a briefing, and the map was in the picture. And the Pentagon tried to yell at us about printing the map after the fact, and the position we basically took was, look, you guys set the ground rules. If you didn't want us taking a picture of the map, you should have said so at the time. But you can't then come back afterward and tell us what we shouldn't or shouldn't have done. And they went away. You know, we have not. Other people may have a different experience, and we may have different experiences in the future, but we have yet to have an example of censorship on the part of the military. It would, frankly, surprise me if they did that. I don't think they need to. And as you say, they can control the timing of a dispatch. But I would submit that an eyewitness account of military action that's 24 hours late is better than none.
Let's go to another caller. Richard joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Oh, what a good time to get into this discussion. Self-censorship. Sometimes, as in North Vietnam, the press is used by governments in order to get information that they can't officially get out. For example, peace feelers. In the situation in North Vietnam, there was a bombing pause. As you may remember, the U.S. government couldn't deal with North Vietnam directly. They had to go through the Polish embassy, and there was lots of difficulty. So there was a bombing pause in May of 66, I think, and it was not attributed to a peace feeler that was being made at the time by the press. There was another one, another bombing pause 6 months later, and that also was not attributed immediately as a peace feeler. Johnson, President Johnson, in his book, The Vantage Point, said that he was disappointed that the press didn't pick up on that. Perhaps that was self-censorship that was applied too strongly.
There's also the similar kinds of judgments about the Bay of Pigs operation in the New York Times. But Andrew Rosenthal, is there self-censorship?
I don't think so. I think we try to put everything in the paper that we can reasonably put into it. If we knew, I can't put myself in that position, but having not been there. But if we knew that the government was announcing something like that, and that the purpose of it, and the reportable purpose of it, in other words, we could get someone to tell us that was true, other than our just speculating, was as a peace feeler to the other side, we would report that. There would be no reason for us not to. I think that particularly when you're dealing with anonymous sources and this kind of sensitive government information, the more you can tell your readers about the motivations of the people who are giving you information, the better you are serving them. I think if you talk about, you know, you have a quote from some government official about a government program, the reader has a right to know whether that official supports or opposes the program, because it gives them a sense of knowing why they're talking to you. And in a case of war, I think those needs become even greater. And helping people understand the motivations of the government in releasing information, I think, is crucially important. We had that this morning in a story about the military's plan to take Basra as an early target in this operation in Iraq. And we struggled very hard in that story to try to talk about the motivations of the military in telling us about this fact.
Richard, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Andrew Rosenthal, we know you're busy today and going to be even busier in the next few days. We appreciate your time.
Grateful for being asked. Thank you very much.
Andrew Rosenthal is assistant managing editor at the New York Times, and he was speaking with us from his office in New York. Coming up after we return from a break, news executives from CBS and National Public Radio. You can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. Our telephone number, if you want to ask questions, is 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how the media covers war and how it may cover the war that could start in the next couple of days. You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from her office in New York City is Marcy McGinnis, Senior Vice President for News at CBS News. And again, we know you're very busy. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Neil. Sorry.
CBS News has made some controversial decisions in the past 18 months or so. Most recently, you aired an interview of Saddam Hussein by Dan Rather. What questions did you ask yourself before you went ahead with that?
Well, we certainly didn't ask the question of should we not interview Saddam Hussein. He is somebody who we are about to go to war with. He is a figure that everybody wants to know more about and what he's thinking about. And the fact that we got, that he did agree to do the interview with Dan Rather was a way that we could help, you know, inform our viewers and our listeners and our web viewers as to what was in the mind of this man who we were about to go to war with.
Another controversial decision. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, at one point asked the major television network news executives not to air Osama bin Laden videos or other al-Qaeda statements without checking with the government first. Now, you've been quoted as saying that you thought that was the correct decision, but also that any act of self-censorship requires great consideration. Can you walk us through that decision-making process?
Well, let me just clarify what she asked, because it wasn't that she asked us not to air video before we checked with the government. What she asked was that we not air video before we saw it and just as it came in put it on, because we could be he could be in a position where he is giving out signals of some sort, you know, to some of his supporters. She expressed her concern about that and did not specifically ask us to do or not to do anything, but to be mindful of the fact that Osama bin Laden could be giving out some kind of strange signals to people that would say, you know, hey, go bomb Americans or kill Americans.
Mm-hmm.
After she got off the phone, the news presidents of the networks got together and made the agreement among themselves that they would not air any Osama bin Laden tape coming in without having seen it and evaluated it first, so that they could decide and the organizations themselves could decide, you know, what exactly this was. So instead, and it's not, if you think about it, it's not a crazy idea. We don't ever air videotape, you know, that's just coming in and putting it back out again without evaluating it. So I just wanted to clarify, you know, what exactly did happen and what we did and did not get asked to do by the government.
Okay. Let's go to a caller. Dan is on the line with us from Seattle.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I had a really quick question. I'm just wondering why, pretty much since post-Vietnam, we never really see one of the real aspects of war, which is death. I mean, not, it's not for gratuity, but it seems to me that that is one of the most obvious aspects of war, and I think it's kind of silly and dumb that we never see that aspect displayed on television.
Never, Dan?
Very rarely, it seems to me.
Well, I think that, in a few wars that have just recently gone by our watch, which was the Gulf War and the war in Afghanistan, part of that issue was the fact that, the press wasn't allowed on any of the front lines, and in fact, basically wasn't allowed anywhere in the field. So we didn't even have the opportunity to shoot anything, whether it be, the soldiers fighting or someone dying or some such thing as it was in Vietnam. I think that Vietnam was one of those wars where you did see death while you were, eating your dinner at the dinner table, and that was, in the government's mind, a good reason why the support for that war went the other way, because, as they said, death was being brought into the living rooms of the American people every single night. I think that in this particular war, it'll be there might be more chance that you might see some of the nastier side of war, simply because we are going to be with the troops this time as opposed to the first Gulf War and the Afghanistan War. So it is yet to be seen what exactly we will see. That being said, one of the things we will not do, and we never do, is show the face of any soldier who has died because his next of kin has probably not been notified.
Right.
So, that's just one of those humanitarian things we wouldn't do. But we struggle with the issues of what's tasteful and to go on the air all the time, whether they be a war or whether it be, a train accident.
Mm.
Or, any kind of issue where there's dead bodies.
Right. It just seems sanitized, and I don't really want to actually see it. It seems that it's just such a part of the act of war.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that the government had a lot to do with the fact that it was a very sanitized war. That we showed a very sanitized war in the first Gulf War.
Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
There are sometimes that TV images are not incorrect, but might distort the impression of the viewer, and a lot of people say that about the images of from the laser guided bombs during the Gulf War 12 years ago. Of course, those were you know, true pictures, but they weren't all the pictures, and they weren't anywhere close to being all the bombs.
Well, I think that's right. I think that, again, it was, you know, the Pentagon's view of the war, and it was, you know, we're going to show you when we did hit our targets, but we're not going to show you when we didn't. And, you know, that's a real problem, and it's something for news organizations in a democracy to struggle with, because when the government only wants to show you what's beneficial to them or what's, you know, puts them in a good light, it's, you know, incumbent upon us to try and find out what exactly is the full story, not just the one side of the story.
Next caller is Sherry, who's on the line from Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question. Last night I was watching ABC News after the president's speech. Ted Koppel was doing a piece on the embedded journalist that you were speaking about with your last guest.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty specific that they were not going to be censored for this war or potential war, that they were not going to have to run anything through the military before they showed it. And they were even speaking to other journalists about it, that this was going to be the first time in history that this was done. And I'm just curious if that was correct, or maybe he wasn't completely accurate.
You know, it's interesting you said that, because I was watching the exact same piece and had the exact same reaction, because we've heard some different things from our end. What we've heard is that there will be some situations where there will be some sort of censorship, and as there was in previous wars, and we have always identified whenever there was, if there was any kind of, you know, military censorship, or you know, the government looked at this beforehand or whatever, we always tell it to our viewers. In this particular situation, this time, we're hearing that there will be some kind of rules and regulations. The previous guest mentioned that there will be times when we can't say, for example, where the troops are, what direction they're moving in, or whatever, just for obvious security reasons for the troops.
Right.
But that being said, I think that there will be some form of censorship, and I think it will, again, what form it takes is yet to be seen. I'm not sure that it will be every single report that we do somebody's going to have to look at. I think that a lot of those decisions will be made by local commanders, and I think, again, it will be very incumbent upon us to state to our viewers when that's happening. I don't think we'll have to state when it's not happening, because that's what the viewer will assume, but when it does, it will. We plan to say, cleared by military censors or something to that effect.
Right, to let us know.
Correct.
But it was interesting. Did you see him speaking with the communications person who said, you know, this will be the first time in history, this will be completely censored?
Yeah, he was very strong, but just yesterday I received word that there was going to be some kinds of censorship.
Sherry, my understanding this does vary from unit to unit depending on the commander.
I think it does. I think a lot of it. I think a lot of what happens with these embeds depends on the local commander. I think that they just can't be dictated from so high up in Washington. I think once you get in there, you know, and the local commander knows you and trusts you and figures out what your deal is, I think they'll be the ones to make the decision, and they'll be the ones to be able to say to you, look, it's not safe right now. Please, whatever you do, don't tell this part of the story. It's going to hurt the troops or whatever. The difficult part comes when there's something bad that's happened and somebody tries to not let us transmit it. That'll be an interesting situation.
Sherry, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
And Marcy McGinnis, we'll let you go. We know you're busy. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Marcy McGinnis is Senior Vice President for News at CBS, and she was with us from her office in New York City. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is our own Bruce Drake, Vice President for News and Information at National Public Radio. And along with that, of course, my boss. Thanks very much for joining us here, Bruce. Busy. What a great get. You know, really tough.
Yeah, I know. I've been pursued by all the networks and the movie story.
We've talked with both of our guests about the pros and cons of embedded journalism. What do you think?
Well, we were offered several embedded journalist slots. We didn't take all of them because we do know that there are probably going to be some limitations. We took two of them. We thought that was a worthwhile thing to do to get that perspective of the war we expect to come. We have other reporters ringed in the region, hopefully just like you did, Neil, in 91, to enter the country and do reporting on their own as that becomes possible. So it's the two reporters we're embedded with the military are just one part of the coverage plan.
Like those other news executives, you also face decisions about reporters in Baghdad. Our friend and colleague Annie Garrels is still there. Is she going to stay?
She is staying put for the time being, and of course, saying the time being has a very short window. We've been in constant touch with Annie. As you know, she's done several tours in Iraq itself, not to mention Kosovo, not to mention some very dangerous assignments in Afghanistan, where she, with her locally hired assistants, made some treks that were perilous during the early days of the war in Afghanistan. We've done a lot of thinking here. We've done a lot of talking with Annie. I think we're at the situation now where you can't, as I think Mr. Rosenthal said, you can't just get on a plane. As you know, it's at best it's a 14-hour journey through the desert. There have been reports, which I don't know have been confirmed or not, that you know some journalist crews that have left have been stopped and their equipment taken away, and you know what their fate is. I don't particularly know. Annie is, as you know, one of the toughest, most courageous, most resourceful journalists. She has very good contacts and networks in Baghdad. We listen very carefully to her sense of the mood of the people there, which she so far has not found hostile. And, you know, as all good and resourceful journalists do, her and her colleagues who are still there, you know, have made plans and options and arrangements, which may not be the most secure in the world, but, you know, have some promise. It's obviously for every reporter in the field and every suit back home, it's an agonizing decision.
Here's an email question. What is the journalist's responsibility to report the views of the Iraqi people? Are there reporters in place to record either with pictures or analysis what may be purported to happen in that country? Obviously, Anne Garrels is in that situation.
Well, and that is what she has been doing. And you know, what has been brilliant about Annie's reporting is that reporters trying to convey the points of view of Iraqi citizens, of course, are always in the care of Iraqi minders, as the phrase goes. And so people are very circumspect about speaking, and what Annie does is a great job of bringing out the nuance of what people say to her.
We're speaking with Bruce Drake, the Vice President for News here at National Public Radio, as we take your questions about what you expect from news coverage if and when the United States goes to war in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our next caller is Steve, who's on the line with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, yes. My comment, I guess, is directed towards NPR and towards the networks in general. I'm interested in how it is that NPR and the networks go about choosing who does the news analysis, who chooses your consultants and news analysts. It strikes me that generally the people who are doing analysis on the news networks and on NPR are either pro-war or pretty soft on the question of war, and I never hear a news analyst who is actually explicitly critical of the war or actually taking an anti-war position. I think of people like, say, Dilip Hero, the well-respected Guardian journalist for The Nation or the Guardian, or Michael Clare from Harvard. We never hear these type of people being consulted as analysts, and I guess I'm concerned about that because in the moment of war, there's a lot of pressure on the news reporters and on news and the news networks in general to rely on military sources or ex-military sources. And I want to know, is it possible to get a balanced perspective? Is it possible for NPR to consult someone like Michael Clare when they're doing stories and news analysis, or Dilip Hero? Or are we going to constantly only hear from either explicitly pro-war positions or people who are basically pro-war with a few very minor reservations?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I understand the caller's concern, but I would argue back to him, and I don't know how much of the coverage he's heard over the weeks, and I should say months, that Iraq has come to center stage. I mean, we use a wide range of experts and journalists. We just actually compiled a database so that we would quickly be able to identify where to find people. And, you know, we have had, yes, ex-military men on. We have had people from, you know, conservative to liberal to mid-road think tanks. And we've also had on several times, just as a specific example, most recently on Weekend Edition Saturday, Edward Peck, who was, I think, a former consul in Iraq, who's very critical of the policy of the U.S. policy there now, and we had Eric Rouleau, who is a former French ambassador in the Mideast, who similarly is very articulate in giving the point of view of the European countries that are not happy with the United States course.
The European media has treated some Iraq-related stories very differently than the American media. For example, allegations of bugging at the United Nations, Hans Blix's report that a number of documents received from the administration seem to be forgeries. Or I think that was from Mohammed al-Baradei, in fact. Why are there discrepancies like that, do you think?
Well, I'm not, you know, familiar with the sourcing of. I've heard some of the stories you've mentioned.
Well, it's almost a matter of emphasis rather than accuracy.
And you know, I think these stories have been discussed here, but you know, I'll have to be upfront with you, you know, Neil, that because I'm not as familiar with how they sourced that story, like the wiretapping story, I can't speak to what our own internal deliberations were on that.
We just have a minute or so left with you, Bruce. I wanted to ask you, what do you think it is that listeners expect from NPR News in a wartime situation?
Well, I mean, I think what I found, Neil, is not only in a wartime situation, but in post 9/11, even the day of the unfortunate Columbia disaster, besides the fact that listeners expect the news here to be comprehensive, measured in the way it's delivered to them, not delivered in a frenetic way. I mean, what struck me by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails after these events that I've read, that in times of trouble, people, our listeners come to us because they feel like they're part of a community. They know you, and they know your voice, and they know Annie Garrels, and they know Robert Siegel, and they know Scott Simon, and it's a place where I think people have found that they get the news, and as much as it can be, they get a certain sense of comfort from the people they hear it from.
Bruce Drake, thanks very much. You're also busy, and it's not going to get any quieter. Our guest has been Bruce Drake, Vice President of News and Information here at National Public Radio. We're talking about how media organizations will cover a war in Iraq. Coming up next, a media watchdog talks about his concerns about media coverage. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As war approaches, many minds are turning to what might happen afterwards. Iraq is a country of diverse ethnic and religious beliefs. What will war mean for its future stability? That's tomorrow's Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're continuing to talk about how news organizations cover war. 2 weeks ago, a group of journalists and journalism professors released a letter criticizing media coverage of the run-up to the war with Iraq. Among their concerns, failure to protest government control of information, failure to maintain an arm's-length relationship with the government, and failure to present a diversity of viewpoints. William Sarin signed that petition. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communications at New York University, and he joins us now from his home in New York, and thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So why did you sign this petition?
Well, I've never signed a petition in years, but I'm not a daily journalist anymore, and I thought the issues were so important that I should sign this, and I did, and I also sent it on to other colleagues at other universities.
Mm-hmm. What's your biggest concern about war coverage?
Oh, I have several concerns. I guess I'd start with a run-up to this thing. I've been angry for weeks now about the so-called secret plans being leaked to the papers, and you see on the front page of all the great papers in this country, all these plans. When I was a young officer, I thought they'd put you in jail for leaking those kind of plans. I'm also concerned with look, my comments are not meant for the C.J. Trevors or the John Burns or the Annie Garrels of this world, but they're meant for a lot of reporters who I think are going to go there and want to try to make their name. And I'm very concerned about how this coverage is going to play out, given the history of this, and given the fact that contention between the press and the government and the military goes back in this country to at least the Civil War, and it occurs time and time again. This embedding process, you could have a reporter who could become a new Ernie Pyle and could write terrific stories. Mr. Rosenthal mentioned this piece that they ran on the front page, and it was just a chilling piece about how, by an embedded person, about how the Marines, in effect, were putting their effects in their certain pocket, and they're getting prepared to die. But so much of the stuff is fed to us, it just concerns me a great deal.
Let's take some calls. Our next caller is Mark, who's on the line with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, I have a quick comment to make, and I think your guest that you have on is probably equally as capable of commenting on it as the lady from CBS was. I got a comment, and then I've got a question. My comment is, and this was originally directed at the lady from CBS, there are a couple of reporters that go back to the Vietnam era, and I'll single one out because I just think he's absolutely somebody that ought to be removed from the airways, which is Bob Simon of CBS, who's made an entire career out of every possible opportunity he can, trying to ridicule, rebuke, and make an issue with the United States military and our government in general. The question that I have is, when I was finishing my graduate degree in journalism, I wrote a number of papers on the press and the military, and one of the things that always fascinates me that nobody ever seems to comment on is the fact that in a time of war, if you have been given credentials by the United States government and are working for them in an embedded situation, that you are directly under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that you are subject to its rules and its regulations, as are any other person in the United States military, and you are subject to court-martial. Mm-hmm. And I go back to Bob Simon, who was credentialed during the last war, broke regulations, broke orders, snuck off trying to get a story, got captured, and was put in an enemy prison camp.
Yeah.
You know, I think they should have left the guy to rot. But
Uniform
Code of Military Justice,
Mark,
and
please,
court-martialed, and he wasn't.
Mark, can we get a time for a reply from our guest, Bill Sarin?
Bob Simon is one of those great journalists who doesn't need a handler, knows how to handle himself in military situations. One of my other complaints is that the Pentagon is, in normal situations, one of the most poorly covered institutions in Washington, and there are a lot of poorly covered institutions in Washington. So most coverage normally is at the Pentagon is by a bunch of folks sitting in chairs waiting for the briefer to come out. So you have a lot of folks now who have been pressed into service who really don't have that experience. CNN has just sent a reporter over, John, this morning, who earlier in the week was going to go cover the Oscars. So I think we have to think of all these things as we read this coverage. And your listeners and readers of newspapers, what they've really got to do is, and as citizens, is read and think and watch as much as they can and make their own decision. Don't trust one outlet. Just try as a citizen to find out from as many outlets as you can what is going on.
In answer to the other question, it's not my impression that reporters are under the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
That's not true.
Email question from Teresa Dorsey in St. Paul, Minnesota. My sister, an airman and AWACS jet engine mechanic in the United States Air Force, has referred to CNN several times as the classified news network. 9 times out of 10 will have heard that news on CNN long before she is allowed to repeat it. I believe the duty of the press is to tell the well-informed truth, but not to put our troops' lives in danger. My big sister's safety is far more important to me than knowing immediately what the military is up to and what its plans are. Delaying information until after an exercise has taken place could potentially save hundreds of lives.
Well, Neil, your listeners should know that no American reporters are going to deliberately put people's lives in danger. It's just not going to happen. So So I don't think that should be a major concern of us. My concerns are, will dead Americans be shown? You know, in World War II, there was not a single body of a dead American shown until 1943. And I think one of your callers early on, will we see these dead bodies? What about the Iraqi people who will be killed in this war? Will we see that? I heard General Wesley Clark the other day on CNN say that there was a tank battle in the first Gulf War that he said was fought on the level of some of the great tank battles in World War II and has still not been reported. That's one of my fears I have about the embedding process. So I would hope editors, good editors, would use the embedding process for what it's worth and then send other folks around. And this is a war that's going to challenge not just war correspondents, but editors and producers here.
Let's go to Claire, who's on the line with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah, hi, Neil. How are you?
Okay.
Yeah, hi. My concern, I'd like your guests to talk about, is that about six corporations own all the media in this country, and I think that the media will censor themselves in this war because, I don't think the military is going to do the censorship. Americans don't seem to know that the Bush administration has promised $1.5 billion in contracts to American corporations to rebuild Iraq. And these corporations are the same ones that own the media. I mean, Bill Moyers talked about this the other night on Now on PBS. And I just would like your guests to please comment on the relationship between big business and accurate media coverage of this war. Thank you.
Yeah, I have maybe what you might think is a curious take on this. I certainly do not defend this large corporate ownership of the media. It's a very dangerous situation. At the same time, I think in a situation like this, that if a reporter's in the field, he doesn't care if he's owned by General Electric or General Motors. He doesn't care. He or she is going to do a great job. And I think most of the editors are. But in a newsroom, publishers don't come down to you or directors don't come down to you and say, I think the story ought to run like this. Let's protect so-and-so. It's a much more subtle thing. I always call it a master narrative in a newsroom, that all of us, as we work in newsrooms, begin to understand subtly what we can say and not we can't say. So I would hope that editors and reporters would exist that master narrative. And can I come back to that piece on the front page of the New York Times? Absolutely chilling story. So that reporter didn't care if who owns the New York Times. It's family owned, but it's a public corporation. But he did a terrific job. C.J. Chivers in the Afghanistan campaign did stories that just would knock your socks off. So that's the challenge to me, that these folks go out there and do that. I'm just concerned about newcomers and people who want to make their names and editors back here who are timid. That's what I'm concerned about. And can we get the whole picture? There'll be a lot of stories, the politics of this war, the economics of this war. We still don't know what it's going to cost. I watched the Ari Fleischman news conference. It's essentially a kept press corps down there. Those are the kind of questions that are important to me.
William Saron, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
William Saron is an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at New York University, and he was on the line with us from his home in New York.